content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we jump right into the main stories this week. The first headline, a frosty showdown between the U.S. and Russia. What happened? U.S.-Russian relations reached a low point this week when President Obama canceled a planned summit with President Vladimir Putin days after the Kremlin granted asylum to National Security Agency leaker Edward Snowden. The White House said Obama had scrapped the meeting after concluding that the two countries were simply too far apart on a range of issues, from the missile defense and human rights to Putin's continued support for embattled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Spokesman Jay Carney said Putin's disappointing decision to grant Snowden temporary asylum last week was also a factor. The two presidents had been due to hold one-on-one talks in Moscow next month following a meeting of leaders of the world's main industrialized nations in St. Petersburg, Russia. Obama still plans to attend that meeting. The White House had signaled for weeks that it was growing increasingly tired of Putin's intransigence, especially on the fate of Snowden, the former intelligence analyst wanted by the U.S. for leaking details of the NSA's surveillance programs. In an appearance this week on NBC's The Tonight Show, Obama said Putin's protection of Snowden, who until last week was holed up in a Moscow airport, reflected the challenges of dealing with Russia. There have been times where they slip back into Cold War thinking, he said. But the Kremlin insisted it had no choice but to grant Snowden asylum, as the U.S. had refused to sign a bilateral extradition agreement with Russia. What the editorials said. Obama made the right call, said the New York Times. Since Putin regained the presidency in 2012, he has tried to boost his strongman reputation with repeated insults to the U.S. He shipped arms to Syria's dictator, even as Obama called for Assad to go. He cut off America's adoptions of Russian children. Now he has decided to essentially stick a thumb in Obama's eye by granting Snowden asylum. The only outcome of an Obama meeting with Russian leader would be to add to Putin's domestic political capital and his already considerable self-esteem. Throwing a hissy fit over Snowden achieves nothing, said Bloomberg.com. The U.S. needs to talk to Putin to understand him, to get a sense of his values. That might prove useful in negotiations over more important matters, like Iran's nuclear program or stopping Syria's civil war. By sacrificing this precious intelligence-gathering opportunity for a 30-year-old hacker, the U.S. does more damage to itself than to Putin. What columnists said. Why did Putin thumb his nose at the U.S. in the Snowden affair? Asked Joseph Jaffe in the Wall Street Journal. Because he could. Putin saw how quickly Obama backed down in 2009 when Moscow protested his plans for an anti-missile defense system in Europe. And he smelled weakness in Obama's failure to stop Russians' arming of Assad. So if you're Putin, why not probe more deeply? Canceling one meeting isn't enough to put Putin in his place, said Nicholas Wapshot in Reuters.com. Obama must hit the autocrat where it really hurts, his bank balance. He could cancel Russia's $572 million helicopter deal with the Afghan army, or scrap the $753 million NASA contract with Russia to ferry our astronauts into space. Far from getting tough with Putin, Obama should be thanking him, said Andrew Cutchins of CNN.com. The ex-KGB agent doesn't like public discussions about state surveillance of citizens, even if they are U.S. citizens. So Snowden's behavior will be tightly controlled by his new host. Should he step out of line and go public with NSA documents, Putin will crush him like a bug. Ultimately, Obama can't do much about Putin's provocation, said Michael Crowley in Time.com. The Russian leader is not an easily intimidated man. Some close observers have even speculated he might be suffering from megalomania. And much like China, Russia isn't a country the U.S. can simply bend to its will, especially not when oil, its main export, sells for well over $100 a barrel. For the foreseeable future, expect America's relationship with Russia to stay about as warm as a Siberian pool party. The second of the main stories, headlined On Trial at Fort Hood. The military trial of Major Nadal Hassan got underway at Fort Hood, Texas this week, nearly 4 years after the Army psychiatrist went on a deadly rampage at the base, killing 12 U.S. soldiers and one civilian and injuring 32 others. "The evidence will clearly show that I am the shooter," said Hassan, who is representing himself. Addressing a panel of 13 senior officers, Hassan, a U.S.-born Muslim of Palestinian descent, said he had found himself on the wrong side of a war against Islam and had switched over, carrying out the mass shooting 3 weeks before he was to deploy to Afghanistan. He took part in proceedings from his wheelchair, having been shot and paralyzed by police officers responding to the attack. The trial follows months of legal wrangling and a change in judges after an unsuccessful effort to force Hassan to shave his beard, grown in violation of Army regulations. More than 30 survivors are expected to take the witness stand and could be cross-examined by the defendant, who faces the death sentence. "This trial is a parade of embarrassments," said Steve Huntley in the Chicago Sun-Times. "Not only has Hassan been allowed to keep his beard, but he also stands accused of terrorism or combat-related murder. Excuse me, not of terrorism or combat-related murder, but of workplace violence. That charge goes against all common sense and cruelly denies his military victims, Purple Hearts, and his survivors better medical care. Hassan, meanwhile, has been able to collect more than $300,000 in pay since the attack." "Even worse, the attack was preventable," said Michael Daly in the DailyBeast.com. "According to a lawsuit brought against the government, the Army and the FBI ignored repeated warnings that an increasingly militant Hassan was bent on jihadist violence. Hassan openly condemned soldiers as war criminals during their psychiatric treatment sessions, and was allowed to communicate with al-Qaeda leader Anwar al-Awlaki under some notion of research. How nuts is that? It'll be a historic trial, whatever the outcome," said Josh Voorhees in Slate.com. "If convicted in a unanimous verdict, Hassan is destined to become the first American soldier in 52 years to be executed. But that verdict would probably trigger a lengthy appeals process that could last for more than a decade." We turn now to the controversy of the week. Fast food workers, do they deserve a living wage? "Americans like to believe that if you work hard enough, you'll make it," said Richard Brodsky in HuffingtonPost.com. "That happy notion is no longer true for many Americans in low-wage retail, service, and food industry jobs, especially fast food workers. That's why thousands of workers at major fast food chains, including McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, and Taco Bell, staged one-day strikes throughout the country last week during peak meal times to demand an increase in their wages, which now average a shockingly low $7.40 an hour. The workers want their pay to double to $15, so they won't have to survive on food stamps and other public assistance. As if to make the protesters' case for them, said Tim Philpott in MotherJones.com, McDonald's inspired much hilarity by issuing a helpful new sample monthly budget for its employees, explaining how to make ends meet on only $1,105 a month. The budget allocates no money at all for childcare, clothing, gasoline, or food, and assumes $955 from income, second job. A low-paying job beats no job at all, said Jillian Melchior in NationalReview.com. If fast food chains had to double salaries, they'd make do with far fewer workers. The business model for McDonald's and its competitors is based on a high volume of sales of low-cost burgers and fries, with very thin profit margins. Paying workers more would mean either raising the cost of a burger by about 25% if workers' wages went to $15 an hour, thus alienating its low-income customer base, or cutting the number of employees and replacing them with touchscreen computers and robotic sandwich makers. Is that what unions and restaurant workers really want? You're not supposed to be able to support a family working the drive-through window at Wendy's, said Deborah Simmons in WashingtonTimes.com. Fast food work requires virtually no education or prior skills and has always been an entry-level job for teens and 20-somethings looking for extra income. The wages are, and should be, commensurate with that fact. If profit margins are so thin, said Daniel Gross in thedailybeast.com, how did McDonald's CEO Don Thompson make $13.8 million last year? Fast food companies have peddled the myth for years that the brutally low wages they pay are a simple function of market forces, but it's emphatically not true. Several burger chains, including In-N-Out in California, start employees at a supposedly ruinous $10.50 an hour, and give them medical benefits, paid vacations, and a 401k plan, too. If McDonald's workers were paid at least $10.50 an hour, the price of a Big Mac would rise by only a nickel. Employees might stick around longer, feel better about their jobs, and provide better service, attracting more customers. That magical world already exists, said Jordan Weissman in TheAtlantic.com. It's Australia, where McDonald's adult workers already earn the U.S. equivalent of $14.50 an hour. As a result, burgers and other menu items cost about 70 cents more, and the franchises save on labor costs by squeezing more productivity out of each worker and replacing some with touchscreen ordering kiosks. Fast food chains in the U.S. probably couldn't double wages overnight, but a raise to $10.50 an hour could be absorbed with some small price increases, use of more technology, and cuts in staffing. It would hardly be a panacea, but workers might no longer need to hold a second 35-hour job to survive. Wouldn't that be worth the trade-offs? And right here at the bottom of the same page, we have the blurbs for a good week four and a bad week four. It was a good week for declarations of faith after a Czech man was allowed to wear a colander on his head for his driver's license photo, claiming the headgear was required by his religion, Pastafarianism. Officials cited the nation's religious equality laws in granting the request. Good week for playing video games after Griffin Sanders, 10 years old, took control of a speeding car when his great-grandmother passed out behind the wheel and steered the vehicle to safety. The Colorado boy credited his driving skills to the hours he'd spent playing Mario Kart. And a good week for rehabilitation after a maximum security prison in Brazil offered its inmates a new way to win early release. Knitting. The convicts, who include armed robbers and murderers, get a day off their sentence for every 3 days they spend knitting. Meanwhile, a bad week for breakfast. After Islamic radicals in the rebel-held Syrian city of Aleppo issued a fatwa banning croissants, claiming their crescent shape was a secret celebration of the West's victories over Muslims. Bad week for Flushing. After British authorities removed a bus-sized fatberg, a congealed clump of food grease and hand wipes, from a London sewer. The 15-ton blob was the biggest congealed lump of lard ever found in the city's sewage system, officials said. And finally, a bad week for Newark, New Jersey, which was voted the world's unfriendliest city by readers of Condé Nast Traveler, edging out Islamabad, number 2, and Oakland, number 3. Newark residents deny that they're rude. "You've got a lot of people who will speak to you," said one local. "Even the people who are homeless." The next article we'll read is in the briefing section. A welfare program for agribusinesses. Farm subsidies are one of the most widely reviled federal programs. So why is Congress fighting to save them? Why is the Farm Bill so controversial? Critics contend that the subsidies it hands out are wasteful, illogical, and counterproductive. A welfare program for millionaires and giant agribusinesses. Over the last decade, the Farm Bill has cost taxpayers more than $168 billion. In theory, the program uses loans, price supports, and payments to protect family farmers from the fickle fluctuations of weather, price, and economic conditions, so that their businesses remain stable and Americans are insured a steady supply of affordable food. In practice, the program keeps food prices high, costing consumers billions, while funneling most of its aid to giant agribusinesses and wealthy farmers. About 75% of total subsidies go to the biggest 10% of farming companies, including Riceland Foods Incorporated, Pilgrim's Pride Corporation, and Archer Daniels Midland. Among the farmers who get federal subsidies are Bruce Springsteen, who leases land to an organic farmer, John Bon Jovi, who owns bee colonies, former President Jimmy Carter, and billionaire media mogul Ted Turner. The typical farmer has literally millions of dollars in wealth, said Dan Sumner, an agricultural economist at the University of California, Davis. What about the average farmer? He's doing pretty well, too. Despite droughts and high temperatures, farmers have enjoyed record crop production levels and prices, as well as double-digit increases to the value of their land for the third year in a row in 2013. In fact, most farmers are wealthier than the average American, with a household income of $87,289 in 2011, 29% higher than the $67,677 average for all U.S. households. And yet many still get taxpayer dollars to protect their incomes. In fact, the Farm Bill pays some farmers not to grow crops in order to avoid oversupply that would drive food prices down for the rest of us. "Only an evil genius could have dreamed this up," said Scott Faber, vice president for governmental affairs at the Environmental Working Group. How did the program start? Subsidies originated during the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl catastrophe of the 1930s, when there was a genuine fear that the nation's agricultural sector was on the brink of collapse. At that time, about a quarter of the country's population lived in rural areas, and tens of thousands of American families found themselves literally in danger of losing the farm. So President Roosevelt pushed through the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which pegged crop prices to their historic highs and introduced the policy of paying farmers not to produce. It was supposed to be a temporary solution to deal with an emergency, as Secretary of Agriculture Henry Wallace put it. But in 1949, the Agricultural Act was made permanent. And, more than six decades later, a version of that same legislation still exists today. Why not reform the program? Congress tried that in 1996 with the Freedom to Farm Act, which removed price supports and grain management in an attempt to let the free market dictate prices. That reform didn't last long. As commodity prices fell and farmers began to complain, lawmakers caved in and introduced several new programs that continue today. They include the much criticized direct payments to farmers, checks written regardless of market conditions or the farmer's crop yields, and the controversial crop insurance program, which critics say has encouraged widespread fraud. In that program, taxpayers pick up 62% of any farmer's insurance premiums and help fund payouts if a claim for crop damage is made. Why not kill subsidies altogether? Politics. The farm lobby has immense power in Washington, thanks to its generous contributions to congressional campaigns and political parties, and to the large number of legislators from farm states, most of them Republican. Democrats have also traditionally supported the farm bill because it contains food stamp funding. This year, that partnership broke down when House Republicans passed a version of the farm bill that strips the legislation of its food stamp provisions for the first time since 1973. President Obama responded by threatening to veto any legislation that doesn't include food stamp funding. At the moment, the situation is at a stalemate. What's likely to happen? A deal will probably get cut that will keep farm subsidies fairly intact. The House version of the bill, in fact, contains some of the most generous farm spending in history. While ending direct payments, the legislation channels $8.9 billion into an expanded crop insurance program, which already ballooned from $1.5 billion in 2002 to $7.4 billion in 2011. In the House bill, moreover, the farm subsidies that used to expire every 5 years are made permanent. It's hard to understand how anyone in the House who calls himself a conservative could support this, but many did, said Chris Ciccola, president of the Free Market-Oriented Club for Growth. They're locking in historically high commodity prices at taxpayer expense. New York City's farmers. New Yorkers wouldn't know it, but they live in a city of farmers. Over the last decade, the Farm Bill has paid out millions of dollars in subsidies to more than 1,500 city residents, 374 of them on the plush Upper East Side alone. They aren't receiving payments for farms in the city, but for property they own elsewhere. Recipients include Mark F. Rockefeller, a fourth-generation heir of the famous family who was paid $342,634 to not farm from 2001 to 2011, so that his land in Idaho could return to its natural state. Other top New York farmers include a managing director at Wells Fargo Bank, and a neurologist in Queens. Payments are going to people in Manhattan who simply have invested in farmland and are about as far away from farmers as one could imagine, said Craig Cox, Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources at the Environmental Working Group. That should really make people wonder what on earth has happened to the farm program. Now we take a look at the best columns from the U.S. The first comes to us from John L. Jackson, Jr. of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Seeing Racism for What It Is. Riley Cooper is a racist, said John L. Jackson, Jr. But that does not make him, but does that make him a bad guy? Some of Cooper's black teammates on the Philadelphia Eagles have publicly forgiven the wide receiver for uttering the N-word during a videotaped rant. An embarrassed Cooper insists he's no racist, and players like quarterback Michael Vick have backed him up. But Cooper's case shows just how poorly he and most other Americans understand what a racist is. Many people think if you're not donning a white sheet and burning a cross on some black family's lawn, or hero-worshipping Hitler, then you're not a racist. But that blatant version has never been racism's exclusive form, even during the worst eras of slavery and Jim Crow segregation. In fact, racists are never only racist. There are other things, too. That's one reason racism is so hard to eradicate. It tricks us into believing it isn't there, and then sneaks up on us, surprising us and those around us with what just came out of our mouths, just as it did with Cooper. It does no good to be so invested in the rhetoric of color blindness that we can't acknowledge an outburst like Cooper's as a textbook case of racism. The next column, Let's Dig In Deeper on Benghazi, comes to us from Connor Friedersdorf of TheAtlantic.com. Maybe I was wrong about the Benghazi scandal after all, said Connor Friedersdorf. In the months after the September 11, 2012 attacks that killed Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans, I tuned out every time I heard the word Benghazi on the news. I saw little evidence of the highly orchestrated cover-up Republicans saw, and figured the deadly assault on the U.S. compound in Libya was a tragic event for which the administration bore no blame. But in recent months, it's emerged that this diplomatic outpost was really a CIA operation, and that dozens of CIA staff were on the night of the attacks, were there on the night of the attacks. Last weekend, a CNN report revealed that to keep the operation secret, the CIA is subjecting its operatives to monthly polygraph tests to ensure they don't speak to the media or Congress. There's speculation that the CIA was secretly funneling Libyan weapons to Syria long before Congress lifted its hurdles on arming Syrian rebels. So far, the CIA's program of intimidation has worked. No one's talking. But now we know that the CIA is, at minimum, trying to hide something huge from Congress. We can't let the agency get away with that. In the final column, from Jonathan Tobin of CommentaryMagazine.com, is titled The Legacy of Rush Limbaugh. Let's take a moment to praise someone who rarely fails to do the same for himself, said Jonathan Tobin. Rush Limbaugh last week celebrated his 25th year on the air. That anniversary passed without notice among mainstream media liberals, who are rejoicing too early over the noises that his network is making about yanking his show. Not even that could diminish the outsized role Limbaugh has played in permanently reshaping America's political landscape. When he started broadcasting nationally in 1988, liberals dominated the media, leaving a huge audience that was dying to hear someone they agreed with. Limbaugh's mix of biting right-wing commentary, humor, and braggadocio gave heart to those long-ignored conservatives. He's been their sounding board ever since, though the left miscast him as an evil Svengali hypnotizing a docile audience of hayseeds and fools. Liberals hate his skewering of their sacred cows, but what really enrages them is that his success means there's no going back to the old days, when impudent conservatives had no place on the national spectrum. How they dream of shutting us up. Thanks to Rush, that will never happen. Our Last Word article this week is about the relationship between NASA and Life magazine in the early years of the space program. The selling of the space program. For 11 years, says Megan Garber, NASA outsourced its PR work to Life magazine. After successfully completing that flight that would make him the first American to orbit the Earth, John Glenn gave a speech at his hometown high school. His old teachers, the astronaut joked, would be very surprised to learn, as the news accounts had it, that he had received straight A's all through school. His football teammates would have been similarly shocked to learn that even while Glenn had sat on the bench, they had sought guidance from him about gaining a few more yards. The people who knew John Glenn, the guy before he became John Glenn, the astronaut, the newly minted hero suggested, must be amazed to read all the gushing accounts of their classmates' various prowesses. Glenn was poking fun at the inevitable trajectories of heroism. The wide-eyed exaggerations, the casual polishings, the careful erosions of inconvenient facts. But he was poking fun, more specifically, at a legal document, a contract between the National Aeronautics and Space Administration and Life magazine, one that sold the Mercury astronauts' life stories to the media outlet exclusively. In exchange for this, Life agreed to obtain NASA's approval before publishing images of and or writings about the astronauts. And it agreed to pay for the privilege, a sum reportedly amounted to, in 1959 currency, some $25,000 per astronaut per year. That's hundreds of thousands of dollars in today's money. Between 1959 and 1963, NASA-approved stories about American astronauts ran in 28 issues of Life. The coverage started with an 18-page spread in mid-September of 1959, which included color photographs of the astronauts in training by the famous Life photographer Ralph Morse. Later coverage would also include images of the astronauts with their families, in their living rooms, in their yards, and, in the case of Scott Carpenter, in a 1962 piece, camping in Colorado. The Life stories depicted America's designated star sailors as they were on Earth, or, at least, as they claimed to be. President Kennedy, David Halberstam, would note, saw Life in those early days of television as the most influential instrument in the country. And the young executive, who had bet a hefty portion of his legacy on shooting the moon, exploited Life's power to portray the nation's newly appointed space travelers as historic frontiersmen. With NASA's cooperation, Arthur Mark Burns puts it, Life magazine lionized and sanitized the original Mercury astronauts, furthering the process of turning the astronauts into bland good guys, which was a process actively supported by Life's publisher, Henry Luce, a man who believed in the influential power of the photograph and whom Halberstam once called the world's most powerful, unacknowledged political propagandist. Luce's magazine, Tom Wolfe would remark, behaved toward the astronauts like the Victorian gent when it came to portraying the possessors of the right stuff, Wolfe noted, the magazine labored to set the proper emotion, the seemly tone. One way Life accomplished this was to do the politest thing possible. Let the astronauts themselves set the tone for their coverage. Several of Life's articles about the astronauts carried the bylines of the astronauts, which wasn't to say, of course, that they were also written by the astronauts. The Mercury Seven were helped along in their literary efforts by the Life writers Loudon Wainwright, Don Shanchi, and Patsy Parkin, and each of their stories contained common elements. Arthur Harlan Mackemson lists them like so. An anecdote from test pilot days, followed by descriptions of astronaut training, an acknowledgement of danger, a sense of duty in accepting the mission, and a projection of what the first flight might be like, he writes, were elements of virtually each story. So while there was no explicit editorial direction for the stories, one of the Life ghostwriters noted, the deal Life made with NASA and the seven individuals created a strong bias toward the Boy Scout image, because all pieces under the astronauts' bylines had to be approved by them as individuals, as a group, and by NASA publicity head Shorty Powers, and whomever happened to be in charge at the moment in Washington. That editing by committee approach led to stories that read almost inevitably as NASA press releases. In a 1973 article for the Columbia Journalism Review, tellingly titled The Selling of the Astronauts, Robert Sherrod described his visit with a team of Mercury members and the Life writers that followed in their wakes. The group passed the time pleasantly, Sherrod reported. One astronaut cooked steaks for the Life crew. Another made pancakes for his son's Cub Scout pack. Another told stories about his rise to astronauthood. The astronauts tried their hardest, in other words, to serve up a good story. These three astronauts went sailing together, Sherrod noted, though they didn't really like each other very much. Given all that effort, it would take some time, Sherrod recalled, for the truth to sink in. These famous young men were doing handsprings for Life because they were being paid for it. Not that the effort much mattered in the end. In the Life story that resulted from all the glad-handing and flapjacking, Sherrod wrote, the astronauts came out, as usual, deodorized, plasticized, and homogenized, without anybody quite intending it that way. There was, of course, some intention for myth-making. Although Life reporters followed the astronauts at home and on the road and witnessed occasional indiscretions, Howard McCurdy writes, such tidbits did not find their way into the mainstream press. Those tidbits included pretty much any detail that would frame the astronauts as men rather than myths. As one Life writer admitted, I knew, of course, about some very shaky marriages, some womanizing, some drinking, and never reported it. The guys wouldn't have let me, and neither would NASA. It was common knowledge that several marriages hung together only because the men were afraid NASA would disapprove of divorce and take them off flights. As another summed it up, Life treated the men and their families with kid gloves. So did most of the rest of the press. These guys were heroes. Most of them were very smooth, canny operators with all of the press. They felt they had to live up to a public image of good, clean, all-American guys. And NASA knocked itself out to preserve that image. What resulted was a kind of a feedback loop of homogenized heroism. NASA, McCurdy notes, used its astronauts to promote the space program, parading them through the White House and across Capitol Hill. Reporters cooperated because it made great copy and permitted them to tag along like technology groupies on an American tour. Life's exclusive arrangement with NASA and its astronauts, unsurprisingly, met criticism from fellow news outlets and journalists. Pauline Kael dryly referred to the Mercury astronauts as Henry Luce's walking apple pies. Newsweek declared Life's portrayal of the seven guys and those in their orbit to be a Barnum-esque extravaganza, with the astronauts themselves acting as cardboard characters of soap operas. The New York Times focused its complaints on the general unsavoriness of astronauts reaping enormous private profits from participating in a great national effort, arguing that Mercury's taxpayer-funded feats belonged in the public domain. Newsweek adopted the same posture about what it called embarrassing financial arrangements. How much a hero can expect to gain financially and still remain a hero, the magazine mused, is uncertain. Their concerns may have been valid. NASA, for the most part, simply ignored them. In the earliest days of the space program, public support was a matter of existential urgency. In the Kennedy administration, author Vernon van Dyke notes, hoped to influence attitudes not simply through space shots, but also through publicity concerning them. It used news agencies, literally, as outlets. NASA worked with the Cleveland Plain Dealer to stage a space science fair to encourage public enthusiasm for space. It dispatched Wernher von Braun, the director of the Marshall Space Center, to write a column about space for Popular Science. And in 1962, the space agency renewed its contract with LIFE. It's hard to imagine today NASA entering into an exclusive agreement with any news outlet, and equally hard to imagine any reputable news outlet agreeing to act, as the scholar James Kaufman put it, as little more than an extension of NASA's public relations program. Times, in that sense, have changed. For all that, though, there's a clear line between the short-lived LIFE contract and the varied publicity efforts we see from NASA today, all of which redound to a single basic insight, that pictures and the stories that accompany them are the best public currency NASA has. Images, an American flag, planted in the soil of the moon, a rocket streaking fire, the selfie from Saturn that went viral last week, offer NASA an elegant way to transcend its own necessary trivialities, its bureaucratic agenda setting, its budget battles with Congress. Those pictures are effective as far as NASA is concerned because they take NASA out of the picture. They remind us instead of space and of the earliest stories we've told ourselves about it. That it is, in a very broad but very urgent sense, humanity's destiny, which was a narrative carefully developed, of course, by NASA itself. Today's NASA, enabled by social media, is a direct continuation of that early urgent contract with LIFE, minus an actual contract with LIFE. Rather than double down on a monogamous arrangement with a single news outlet, though, NASA has instead invested in promiscuity. It seeks to concentrate public attention not through one platform, but through several, and in fact, as many as possible, with its content licensed not to a single outlet, but rather to the Creative Commons. NASA offers a firehouse of images, as well as news and historical tidbits, and recently birthday greetings to Will Wheaton of Star Trek: The Next Generation, on its $4.5 million follower Twitter feed. NASA works with its astronauts to produce viral-friendly YouTube videos about life in space. It makes those astronauts available to the public through regular Google Hangouts. It encourages those astronauts to take pictures and write poetry and record music videos. And it's not just astronauts who do the work of publicizing space. Yesterday afternoon, a group of the scientists and technicians overseeing the travel of the Mars Science Laboratory, nay Curiosity, the little rover that could, did a Reddit Ask Me Anything. In some ways, NASA's tentacular publicity efforts are unique to the NASA and to the world of 2013. All the truisms that the Internet has brought to the worlds of advertising and publicity, direct user engagement, authenticity, have found their ways, inevitably, to the space agency. NASA's contract with LIFE ended in 1970, 11 years after it had begun. It lives on, though, in some sense, in every story we tell ourselves about space and humans' place in it. It lives on in every tweet and Tumblr post and Facebook update and email blast, in every attempt to capture and then maintain our attention and our love. It lives on in the attention and in the fact that when we talk, still with wonder about human success in putting a man on the moon, we're less inspired by the moon itself and much more inspired by the man. This comes to us from the Atlantic Media Company, as first published in the Atlantic Magazine. Moving over to the Health and Science page, we start with an article, The Evolutionary Roots of Monogamy. As an evolutionary strategy, monogamy has long puzzled scientists. When a male pairs off for life with one female, he limits how many offspring he can produce, thus reducing his chances to pass on his genes. Few species are monogamous, yet 5% of the mammal species are, including wolves and beavers, and about a quarter of primates. To find out why, British scientists gathered data on the mating behaviors of 230 primate species and used computer simulations to analyze how they evolved. Their conclusion, males began sticking around their mates to prevent other males from killing their offspring. When unrelated males have access to females with babies, the study found, they tend to get rid of the babies because it ends the suckling period and makes the moms fertile again. Infanticide is a real problem, particularly for social species, anthropologist Christopher Opie tells the Washington Post. By coincidence, a separate group of researchers just completed their own study on monogamy, and they came to a different conclusion. Pair bonding evolved, they say, when females of some species began living away from other females, spreading out to get more food. Males had to move in with them to fight off other suitors and to preserve their sexual access. Tim Clutton Brock, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Cambridge, cautioned against applying these studies to modern humans, especially given how humans behave. I'm far from convinced that humans are really monogamous. Manufacturing memories. Memory is notoriously unreliable. Eyewitnesses have sent innocent people to jail, and two people can give conflicting accounts about the same event. In a new study, the New York Times reports, MIT researchers have shown how false memories can form and how they might even be implanted. The researchers placed mice in an unfamiliar box and used chemical tags to mark the cells in the hippocampus portion of their brains that became active as a memory of their surroundings formed. Then, they transferred them to a different box and gave them an uncomfortable electric shock while stimulating the brain cells they'd marked in the first box. When they finally returned the mice to the original harmless box, the rodents stiffened in fear, suggesting that they remembered, wrongly, that it was where they'd been shocked. The mice didn't feel frightened when transferred to their new boxes, showing they had a specific false memory attached to the original box. Human brains likely encode memories in a similar way, and the research should make people realize even more than before how unreliable human memory is, says study author Susumu Tanigawa. An effective diet strategy. The key to losing weight and staying slim may be dieting for only 2 days a week. A growing body of research suggests that 5-2 diets, which involve eating normally for 5 days and restricting your intake for 2 days to between 500 and 1,000 calories, are effective both in keeping weight off and in improving overall health. In a study on rats, researchers at the National Institute on Aging say the periodic fasting appears to improve the blood sugar levels of the rodents and help keep them lean, NPR.org reports. It even appears to boost their cognitive skills. And a study of 100 overweight women in England found that those who followed a 5-2 diet, eating healthy Mediterranean-style meals for 5 days and a low-calorie, high-protein meals without carbohydrates for 2 days, lost more weight than women who tried to cut calories all week. The big advantage of 2-day diets, researchers say, is that they seem to train people to eat less overall, without making them feel deprived. And we finish up with the talking points. Obamacare. Will millennials sign up? There are 2.7 million reasons why Obamacare could fail, said Karen Agnes in USNews.com. That's the number of young, healthy 18 to 35-year-olds the White House says must enroll in order for the law to work as intended. But will that many sign up? Premiums for 20-somethings could rise by up to 42% when the law goes into effect. And the fine for not buying insurance is as little as $95 a year. If young people decide to pay the fine rather than buy insurance, premiums will go up for everyone else, threatening the entire system's survival. That's why conservatives are enlisting youth in their fight against Obamacare, said Alex Seitz Wall in Salon.com. The Heritage Foundation sponsored BuzzFeed.com post last week stressing the law's cost for the young and healthy. The Tea Party group FreedomWorks is encouraging young people not to buy insurance until they get sick or hurt, and then take advantage of the law's ban on denying coverage due to pre-existing conditions. They're out to convince millennials that Obamacare is bad for the Obama generation. That won't be as easy as they think, said Jonathan Cohn in NewRepublic.com. Young people worry about getting sick. Two, a Kaiser poll found that 87% of them consider it personally important to get insurance. And 66% they worried about medical bills. Young people on low wages will qualify for federal subsidies, so that a 25-year-old making $20,000 a year will likely pay only $42 a month for a basic plan. And the penalty for carrying no insurance will eventually rise to $695, making it an ever less attractive alternative. This law merely asks young people to exercise a minimum of personal responsibility for their own health care, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. Yet some Tea Partiers are urging the young to stiff the system. Why is freeloading now a conservative value? Conservatives needn't urge young people to sabotage Obamacare, says Ramesh Ponuru in Bloomberg.com. This law sabotages itself. The higher cost of health insurance for many young people is a clear disincentive to buying it, particularly since they can safely refuse to do so until they need it. Failure is assured when you design a law that depends on people's acting against their self-interest. Whatever Obama or conservatives say, millennials will vote with their pocketbooks in 2014. If they decide the law has made buying insurance a waste of money, they won't do it. Baseball. A-Rod strikes out. Alex Rodriguez has achieved a dubious new record, said Tom Verducci in SportsIllustrated.com. Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig this week banned 12 players for 50 games for using performance-enhancing drugs. But he slammed A-Rod with the longest drug-related suspension in the game's history, a 211-game ban through the end of the 2014 season. The New York Yankees star third baseman was alone in contesting the ban, filing an appeal that allows him to keep playing in the meantime. That's just more proof that A-Rod has no shame, said Christine Brennan in USA Today. Selig reportedly has evidence that in addition to using illegal drugs, Rodriguez conspired to block baseball's investigation of the Florida clinic that supplied them. And this isn't his first offense. He previously admitted doping from 2001 to 2003. A-Rod's stubborn fight against banishment guarantees that more details about his alleged drug use will come out. But that's a risk this test tube slugger seems willing to take in order to keep collecting his $275 million salary, the highest in baseball. This feels like a setup, said William Roden in the New York Times. There are no eyewitnesses to Rodriguez's alleged performance-enhancing drug use. The only incriminating evidence investigators have is the testimony of two questionable characters who worked at the Florida clinic, one of whom impersonated a doctor. A-Rod's flaws make him the perfect target for a show trial, said Sally Jenkins in the Washington Post. He is an incurably self-conscious phony and a tone-deaf egoist who loves making money more than playing the game. Widely loathed, A-Rod is a convenient whipping boy for a commissioner eager to punish a star player, but reluctant to sanction the club owners who profited handsomely from his supposedly drug-powered home runs. Rodriguez's suspension, once finalized, won't clean up the game, said former baseball commissioner Faye Vincent in the Wall Street Journal. When a doped-up player can earn hundreds of millions for a multi-year contract, going a few months without pay may just seem like the cost of doing business. Clearly, Major League Baseball needs a simpler drug policy. One violation and you're out. Forever. That worked with gambling, and it will work with drugs. It had better, because the game can't survive unless everyone plays fair. When rules are ignored, we get professional wrestling or theater, but not sport. And a few short notes here. France is the world's most popular country for tourists, with over 16 million more visitors a year than the U.S. in second place. Only about a sixth of those tourists go to Paris, however. The most visited city in the world is Bangkok. A super PAC called Ready for Hillary has raised $1.25 million in less than 3 months, despite the fact that Hillary Clinton has yet to announce her candidacy for the 2016 presidential election. Three-quarters of contributors sent $25 or less. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.